Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita.
I'm Ron.
And I'm Jean Marie.
Collectively, we're the hosts of Podcast DX. On today's show, we're speaking with Dr. Kat Ogle. Dr. Ogle is a board-certified emergency medicine physician currently practicing at the George Washington University Hospital in Washington, D.C. She's a first-generation college graduate and physician. Dr. Ogle's first foray into healthcare was as a registered nurse. Hooah! I like that.
Well, and can I just stop you right there? Are we pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, you are.
Excellent. And before attending medical school, she was a RN for 7 years. Dr. Ogle is joining us today to talk about discrimination and racism in the healthcare industry. Excellent topic. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Ogle.
Hi, Dr. Ogle.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
And it's a great topic.
Yes. Dr. Ogle, I'm curious, what actually inspired you to pursue a career in medicine? And also, at what point did you decide to go to medical school? And why did you decide to make that transition?
So I always wanted to be a physician. And when I was young, the answer was fairly cliche in that I wanted to help people. And initially, I thought I wanted to be a psychiatrist. And now that I've been involved in patient care for 23 years, because I graduated from nursing school in 97, which is a little hard to believe, I can more clearly articulate that my role as a physician has everything to do with my desire to serve, to ease suffering, and to educate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I grew up in a blue-collar family, and as a result, I didn't have many mentors or guides. And by the time I was graduating from high school at 17, the only thing I knew about medicine was that it was really long and really expensive. And because I was responsible for financing my own education, I had to be thoughtful about how I was going to make it happen. Nursing ended up being a stepping stone for me, which allowed me to assess whether or not medicine was the right fit. And during my 7 years as a nurse, I took on varied leadership roles in the hospital, was code team leader and whatnot, and I was always hungry for more knowledge. Once I got into the surgical ICU, I always had questions about the why behind each intervention. And in a lot of cases, I was just dismissed by the physicians and told to do my job. There was a key moment for me in the surgical ICU when I was assisting an anesthesiologist with a particularly complicated procedure that I had seen a number of times. And I had memorized every single step of the procedure and anticipated his every move. And that was the moment for me when I realized that I wanted to be the one who was doing the procedures and making the medical decisions. I wanted that foundational knowledge and responsibility of taking care of my patients.
That's excellent.
Yes, yeah. It is. Well, we're talking this morning about discrimination and racism. How does discrimination and racism affect the healthcare industry, being a doctor and working with patients?
Mm-hmm. So there are several ways in which I think discrimination and racism impact the healthcare industry. And part of it has to do with the ways in which we as healthcare providers interpret the patient's complaints. If we make certain assumptions about a patient before they even open their mouth, that's going to impact how we perceive their complaints. It is going to impact the way we perceive how engaged they are with their own healthcare management. It impacts the way we treat pain. We have actually good evidence to show that there's a significant difference between the way physicians treat pain in Caucasian patients and the way they treat pain in African American patients. There was some research done that actually demonstrated that physicians thought that the pain receptors in Black patients was different than the pain receptors in Caucasian patients. There's also, there have been recent studies done in medical school where the medical students were asked about the physiologic difference between the skin of a Black patient and the skin of a white patient. And a number of them, a majority of them actually thought that Black patients had thicker skin. Now, there's no scientific basis for this. There's no biological basis for this. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But this is just one example in which I think our perception of race and its intersection with health is changing the way we treat patients. I think the other thing is when you think about healthcare outcomes, and particularly healthcare outcomes as they relate to social determinants of health, people are having poorer outcomes. And it is very much tied to how they get their care. And we are showing, we're demonstrating that our discrimination and unfortunately some racism which exists in medicine, either due to most of the time, I think it's implicit bias, but there are also explicit biases, and they intersect with the care that we're providing for our patients. As physicians, it's really important that we examine the assumptions that we're making about our patients, and we have to be very careful about taking note of the assumptions that our colleagues are making. And this is everyone in the healthcare team, from the radiology and lab care technician to the nurses and the techs who are facilitating hands-on care, and our physician colleagues. Because as I said, I think most of the time, this discrimination lies more on our implicit behaviors, which are really just sort of our reflexes. They're just things that are based on how we grew up, the environments we lived in, and just our general perceptions. It's not an active thing. And sometimes it takes a colleague who is being mindful and thoughtful about the care that you're delivering to somebody to point something out to you for you to actually be able to see it and to recognize it.
Okay. That's gotta be a very difficult task. You've got to really be walking on eggs if you're trying to correct a colleague that you recognize a possible.
But it's vital.
It is vital, but it's got to be difficult. It's got to be a very difficult thing to do and brave.
It is difficult. And I have to say that in recent times with, you know, all of the events around the deaths of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and George Floyd, I have sort of been inspired to examine my own practice and the things that I have done in my career and sort of be reflective about it. And it is difficult, but I think that it's essential. And in my work that I've been doing recently, I am learning language that fosters less defensive conversations with colleagues.
Okay.
You know, it's more like, I noticed this happened. Did you notice that? Because it's not about saying you were wrong and you're a terrible doctor and you did something that you shouldn't have done. It's more like, I noticed this and I was wondering if it had anything to do with this. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it just starts a conversation. It doesn't put someone on the defensive.
Right.
And that's really, I think, where the work is going to have to start, is in just simple conversations.
I can see why you were going to be a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. You kind of have that thread going through your psyche.
We see a lot of psychiatric cases in the emergency department,
so it is
weaved into what I do for certain.
Okay.
For lack of a better word, is there any like sensitivity training that the doctors have to get on maybe an annual basis or semi-annual or something where some of this stuff might be discussed in general so that you're not necessarily directing it at a certain person, but it's just general information for people to learn?
Mm-hmm. So there is regularly training on implicit bias. It tends to be part of our required CME for our licensure and whatnot. The interesting thing about implicit bias training, however, is that it doesn't actually lead necessarily to behavior change. And that is something that has come out in the recent literature. So implicit bias training identifies a person's implicit biases, but unless they take independent individual action to take note of it and to be mindful of it, it's not going to change the way they practice. So I'll give you just a specific example about myself in particular. So there are some experiences that I've had in my life that I don't think some of my physician colleagues have had. And I talk about it a little bit in the book, but I grew up in an alcoholic and abusive home environment. And so I have a different perspective with regard to my patients who are coming in suffering from alcoholism and as victims or perpetrators of intimate partner violence. And because of my experience, in some ways, I have my own implicit biases around these topics, and it changes the way I interact with some patients. There are some patients for whom I'm able to make a really solid connection based on my prior experience. However, there's some patients that, because of the way they remind me of some of my experiences, I'm actually uncomfortable before I even go into the room. And that, I think, is the clue to every physician, is when you start to feel a discomfort, or you start to feel an assumption, or you start to feel uncomfortable with a particular patient complaint, that is the moment, this is where the change comes in. That is the moment where you sit with yourself and say, I am a physician. I am here to alleviate suffering. I am here to treat healthcare problems. I am here to help this patient. And so for the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes, I'm going to invest in this patient, acknowledging that I have some preconceived notions and biases, but I am going to make an active effort to direct my energy for the benefit of this patient. And that simple change, for me, I think has made a positive impact on my ability to care for patients.
Well, that's excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. That may or may not lead into my next question. sorry if I'm going off track. How can healthcare professionals establish trust with their patients?
So I think this actually is a perfect lead-in, because it is that implicit bias. Excuse me, it's that implicit bias which may actually lead to your patients distrusting you. So it's sort of being mindful before you even go in. I think that's part of it. But as I'm sure you guys can all agree, trust is the foundation of what we do in providing healthcare to our patients. If you cannot establish trust, you cannot establish a solid healthcare plan. Mm-hmm. And your patients will not follow through with what you recommend, right?
Exactly.
And
right.
So I think the simplest first step is to listen to your patients. To actively listen to them. And if you find yourself, while you're listening, starting to get in your head to try to craft a response, or you're making an assumption, or you're coming up with a counter argument to the patient's experience or their statement or their story, take a pause. Make sure you are truly listening to the patient. Make sure you're taking it in, because you are not living in that patient's skin. You are not living that patient's experiences.
Right, right.
Then I think the next step after that is to make sure that you're taking the time to explain things to them in a language that they understand. Make sure that they can explain it back to you. So, because the thing is that you ask a patient, so do you understand? And they all say yes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to appear as if, you know, they don't want you to perceive them as stupid or not listening or anything like that. So there's, yeah, I totally get it. Okay, well, explain it back to me. I want to make sure that you have a solid foundation for what we've discussed. Because if they can't explain it back to you, then they don't understand it. And I think the final step is really making sure that your patient feels like you're a partner with them, and that you're going to work collaboratively with them to help address their health concerns.
Okay, thank you.
Well, and on the flip side of Lita's question, if a patient feels that they're not receiving the level or quality of care needed to address their medical conditions, or that they haven't established trust and they don't trust their healthcare provider, how would you like them, or how would you like your patients with that kind of a situation to address those concerns with their healthcare provider?
Mm-hmm. I think it's really tough. And I think it depending on where and when they grew up, there are some generational impacts on this, because some patients are much more deferential to their physician, and there is much more of a power differential perceived in the relationship with their physician. But I encourage all of my patients to feel empowered to express their concerns to me. And if they find that they're not getting the answer that they were hoping for, or they're not making progress, they can use language like, I'm concerned about X, or I'm worried about Y. And when they use that language, because I think what I've noticed is when there's tension between a patient and their physician, and the patient does not feel like they're getting what they expect to get, it is, you're not listening to me, and you're not doing this, and you're not doing that. And that immediately puts the receiver of that language on the defensive. Mm-hmm. So if the patient articulates it from the perspective of them, I am feeling this, I am concerned, I am worried, then it kind of pulls the other person in the conversation in, who is also human and may make mistakes in communication.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, ultimately, if they can't get through to their healthcare team, to the physician they're working with, they can ask for a patient advocate who may have more time to sit down with them and discuss their specific concerns, and can feed it back to the medical team in a different way. In the worst case scenario, patients may need to find a new physician, and they should also feel empowered to do so if they truly feel like they are being dismissed. I think from the physician standpoint, if we find ourselves in a situation in which a patient is expressing a concern and we go on the defensive, one of my mentors gave me this advice when I get fired up about things. And she said, don't get furious, get curious. When you make a concerted effort to truly understand the other person's perspective, it is going to foster a discussion as opposed to put up walls.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice.
Yeah.
And I actually have a follow-up question. You have, mm-hmm. you're coming from a very unique, you know, you have a very unique perspective where you've seen different aspects of healthcare. When you were working as a registered nurse, did patients ever approach you and with concerns about their care or how their physician was treating their condition?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think that it's been a number of years because I got into medical school in 2004. So I definitely remember patients coming back to me. But I mean, I think it even comes in medical education, like the patients will speak to the medical student about something that the attending physician or the resident physician may not be hearing, or they'll speak to the resident about something that maybe the attending physician isn't hearing.
Okay.
Yes, that definitely comes up. For me, I think I have fewer memories of that as a nurse, because in the intensive care unit, most of the patients were very sick, intubated, right. Sedated, not super communicative.
Okay.
So,
Dr. Well, I'm going to switch up a little bit because everything we're talking about right now is human to human. But what about bias or racial or ethnic bias when it comes to software being used in the healthcare industry by the providers and the insurance companies? Is there anything being done to address any of that bias?
Mm-hmm. So I think this is a tough question, first off, and I am not a software or health IT expert, nor am I a policy expert. However, I have friends who are, and, you know, as we begin this intensive work on an anti-racist pathway, I think what you will find is as we start to really examine the systemic and institutionalized racism that exists in our society currently, we are going to start uncovering and identifying ways in which the electronic medical record or software is in fact leading to more problems for our patients than solutions. I can think of one specific thing in our EMR, our order entry system, in which there's an automatic calculation for renal function or kidney function that is adjusted based on race.
Oh, okay.
And I mentioned this before, but there is no biologic basis for this. This is based on studies which were done that have since been sort of debunked. And it is, race is not a biologic factor impacting healthcare. It does not impact a person's physiology. And we have to be very careful to work in collaboration with our health IT experts and with policy experts to adjust the ways in which insurance companies are addressing, you know, different interventions that are done for patients, different medications which are prescribed for patients, and to sort of take these things out of the electronic medical record. Because having it in the electronic medical record, it's almost like you just start keeping it and putting it somehow in your brain as a fact and as truth. And that's not productive.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, well, that's good information to know. Thank you.
I wonder if that's the if there's a similar trend with robotic doctoring.
You mean with the virtual, like, are you talking about telemedicine, or are you talking about something different?
No, actually, robotics.
Where they're, well, okay, I don't know. I'm not going to put words in your mouth.
Well, they've had some growth, I guess, growth in the industry where they're using.
Are you talking about for like diagnostics?
Right. Like a computer program that will actually diagnose for you, and take that tool away from the doctor who has the eyes and the ears and the heart to listen to the patient, whereas the diagnosis is being done purely black and white on a screen, you know,
and I guess I can give another example of this. It has nothing to do with computers, but in the military, medical personnel are given basically a flow chart to follow.
There you go. That's where
when it comes to diagnosing a patient, and there can be issues with that as well if race or bias isn't incorporated into that flow chart.
So I think that that's an interesting question, and there are a couple of ways in which, I guess we would call it artificial intelligence, is how I would use the computer-based analysis of a particular clinical situation. So I'm also a sonography expert. I use sonography on a regular basis in my practice.
Wow.
And there's some interesting artificial intelligence specifically related to imaging. And in some ways, these artificial intelligence systems are being developed by teaching the machine learning to recognize patterns on a computer screen as you go through the different slices of an image. So if you guys think of a slice of bread, right? Let's pretend it's like got raisins in it. Okay, so you've got the slices of bread, and so the raisins are in different positions in different parts of the slices. And so on a usual basis, that's what a CAT scan looks like. It's basically slices through a patient's body. And so if you think about a human going through every slice, you know, over and over and over again, and they're doing this for 8 hours in a row, and they're staring at a computer screen over and over and over again, there is a possibility that we might miss something. Okay. Whereas a computer program that is designed to recognize changes in the shades of gray that are on the screen, the patterns and whatnot, it has no impact on the patient's race, you know, socioeconomic status, anything like that. It's simply going through and analyzing the data. It sees those pictures as data.
Okay.
And so Similarly, the folks who are working on artificial intelligence in ultrasound are thinking about using artificial intelligence in ultrasound, not to take away my role for what I do as a, you know, an educator, but more to expand the capacity of potential primary care providers who don't normally do ultrasound, but who might have a pocket ultrasound to be able to take pictures of somebody. And the artificial intelligence can talk them through the ways in which they need to move the probe to get the pictures.
Okay.
so that the program can actually analyze what it's seeing on the screen and provide the physician with useful data. Now, these things are still in progress, but I think in some ways, a computer system or machine learning or artificial intelligence might actually be better at eliminating bias than a human.
Okay.
Even the most well-meaning human, because even the most well-meaning anti-racist advocate still has intrinsic and implicit biases that impact their decision-making.
Yeah, they weren't raised in a bubble.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense. I know the Veterans Administration uses some AI even in mental health care and counseling. And they have noticed that there's less bias when it comes to that, and that sometimes patients will open up more because a human counselor will have all those micro expressions and reactions to the patient and what the patient is saying, whereas the computer will not. And the computer can actually analyze the patient's micro expressions and utilize that information, their nonverbal expressions, to enhance care and improve care. But on the flip side of that, I'm thinking about facial recognition software, where someone is programming the computer to recognize individual faces, and its utilization with the police and law enforcement, and how that has been found to be problematic because the computers are not programmed to the point where they can differentiate specifically African-American faces to the point where they have wrongly identified a female individual as the individual that they were looking for when the actual perpetrator was a male.
So in other words, they haven't gotten far enough.
Hasn't gotten to the point where it's able to differentiate. But I'm thinking, because you said, you know, like as far as internal organs and their placement and possible you know, recognizing disease, that sounds amazing. That a computer can, you know, because it can do millions and millions of processing
without error.
Without error and without end, and can really enhance your ability to treat your patients.
Right.
I'm sorry, I didn't really have
We really went off script.
Yeah, I'm very, very, very sorry.
You can tell it's early.
I was going to go a little bit different route, but I was just kind of watching this train go by.
I'm sorry, so. We could listen to you all day.
Yes. All right, one more question, or a different question. What about health education and preventative medicine? How can providers ensure that everyone receives quality care as far as the education of the patients and preventive medicine given to the patients?
I think the one thing that we have to be very careful about with regard to patient education is that we're not perpetuating assumptions about certain populations. The only way to ensure that people are actually provided or receiving adequate health care is to really look at patient outcomes and public health data. And that is not everybody's purview. That's not everybody's expertise. Not everybody who engages in preventative medicine is an expert in those areas. And so we have to be thoughtful about the educational materials that we're providing to patients. And like, for example, if you are in an area in which there is a high patient population from a certain ethnic background, your teaching materials should have pictures of people that look like them. It's a very simple thing to do to make sure that your educational materials demonstrate a diversity of patients. So, because imagine what it would be like if you got a piece of paper, recommendation, a brochure from your physician that had a bunch of pictures of people that don't look like you and have all of these descriptions of how you should manage your weight and how you should manage your blood pressure. And whether or not you realize it, because nobody in the brochure looks like you, you're less likely to believe what you're reading.
Sure. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Because you're not identifying with them.
Right.
I mean, and this is, again, I'm going very off topic, but we travel quite extensively. And one thing that I always notice and am surprised by, because we're from Chicago, is when you watch your nightly news and your local news, and how often the newscast crew is not diverse, and how surprising that is, and how getting information from a diverse group of individuals to me feels far more comfortable than getting information from a group of people that look nearly identical, and have, there's no variety as far as backgrounds and what they could be bringing as far as information to the table. And it's just very disconcerting.
I totally agree with you. And I think that, you know, again, this is off topic, but that goes back to sort of the hiring practices of the organization who's managing the news, you know, so, and I think that that goes back into sort of the more institutionalized and systemic biases that we have that may impact hiring practices and make it so that we have a much more monochromatic staff than we should. I also wanted to go back a little bit to the preventative healthcare and patient education piece, because one of the things I was thinking about is the social determinants of health and the conversations that we have with our patients. And if you don't talk to the patient about where they live, what their grocery store looks like, what their access is to healthy food, telling them to eat healthy and decrease their salt intake is pretty limited. You're not giving them the tools they need to succeed. And so asking them, okay, well, walk me through your typical week of what you eat, where you get your food, and how you access it. Because what you may find is that this is a person who works two jobs. They don't have time to go to the grocery store and get, you know, fresh foods and prepare them, because they go from one job to the other. So their only option is to go to 7-Eleven or to go to the you know, corner market, or to go to McDonald's or Burger King or Taco Bell or whatever the fast food is on the way to their other job. So then you can ask them, well, how, what part of your week do you have in which, like, how much time do you think you can spend each day thinking about your health? So to change the framework a little bit for them, help them understand that this is a part of their success in life as a healthy person. And so how much time do you think you can spend thinking about this? So if they can spend 15 minutes thinking about it, look at their path to work. Maybe there's a grocery store that's close by. And so maybe they can pop into the grocery store and get like a pre-prepared meal from that portion of the store, which will be a little bit healthier than the frozen burrito or the tacos or whatever. Because, you know, hey, look, the grocery store has these salads. They're like $3. You know, you can get the salad, you can get yourself, you know, some water, you can get this. And, you know, it's simple things. You can't expect people to make overnight, like, I don't eat properly. Like, I have trouble managing, you know, a healthy lifestyle in the midst of what I'm doing. So, like, you have to sort of take into consideration what is feasible for the patient, what is reasonable. And you know what? The next time you see them, you better celebrate their successes. If they have gone down from doing fast food every day to doing fast food only 3 days a week, that's fantastic. That is progress. That is moving a target in the right direction. And it takes, they've done research on this, it takes 21 days to solidify a new habit. And so if you give them 18 things to do, they're guaranteed to fail.
Right.
You give them one thing and you ask them to change that one thing for a solid 3 weeks. And then you celebrate their success. You look at how it's impacted them. You you ask them how proud they are of themselves for being able to engage in that modification. And then they're going to be more motivated to do more like that in the future.
Excellent. Yes.
Yeah. It sounds like we just need a few thousand more Dr. Ogles in the world, and everything would be great.
Well, thank you very much. I mean,
doesn't
that.
Everyone listening right now want to switch doctors?
Okay, see, that's the thing is, I am an emergency doctor.
Yes. Well, your emergency room patients are very lucky to have you.
Yes.
And I want to go back to medical school. How does racism affect students in medical school? Is racism like built into the very education of future physicians and even getting into and applying for medical school? And I don't know if you're aware of this or not. How does race come into play?
Mm-hmm. So I want to tackle the first question mm-hmm. with regard to how racism impacts medical education. So we are exploring this in my institution right now. And we have come to recognize that systemic and institutional racism is, in fact, impacting the House of Medicine and the education of our future physicians. There are multiple points in our curriculum in which we are perpetuating some of these biases. And it's racial bias, it's social bias, it is socioeconomic status bias, it is gender bias. So we really need to do better with this. And, you know, an example is when, medical school is broken up to the preclinical years and the clinical years, okay? And so in the preclinical years, there may be cases that are presented in a class in which, you know, the dermatology section is a great example. They show you all these rashes. Okay, here's this rash, here's how you differentiate between these different rashes. This is Lyme, and this is, you know, shingles, and this is, you know, this tick infection and this other bacterial infection. And by and large, the vast majority of those pictures mm-hmm. are on Caucasian skin.
Oh.
And so it leaves your students who are persons of color, or it leaves your students who are passionate about taking care of populations who are persons of color to wonder, well, what does this look like on a person of African-American descent? What does this look like on a person of West Indian descent? What does this look like on a person of Middle Eastern descent? And the fact is, we don't know, because we don't have, like, and that's a little bit of an overstatement. It's not that that's a fact. Most of the information that we currently have is limited. And so this is an area in which we can develop, so we can engage our dermatology colleagues in creating resources which provide the examination and the assessment of these skin diseases mm-hmm. across the board, across all colors of skin. Because that is limiting our ability. It's limiting our students' ability to learn, okay, well, how do I recognize lupus on this patient?
Sure.
You know, I might just think that that's a fungal rash when in fact it's lupus. So that's one place. I think the other thing we have to think about is that the content of the curriculum that we're learning across the way leads to, you know, the ways in which we provide care in the hospital. And so I remember having a very impassioned conversation with one of my students who's in my medical education and leadership track. And this person was so frustrated by the fact that, you know, they had only ever seen cases presented to them on sickle cell disease. It was always an African American patient.
Oh, right.
And then they might also sort of insert that the patient was pain seeking or addicted to opiates.
Oh.
And the fact is because of the crisis,
because of a sickle crisis.
This is where it gets complicated. Mm-hmm. There are ways in which we can miss identify and miscategorize patients. Mm. And if it gets taught in multiple different ways, people start making the assumption that, mm-hmm. okay, well, every sickle cell person is an African-American person,
right.
and every sickle cell person is addicted to narcotics, oh. and every sickle cell person is pain-seeking when they come into the ED or the hospital, things like that. And it's not, it's simply not the case,
right?
But you can only present so much information to medical students before they go off into clinical practice. So if the only thing they've seen is that sickle cell patients are Black, they need pain medicine, they need opiates, and they're going to be very demanding, then they already come in with that assumption. And so the first sickle cell patient they see, that's going to be what their assumption is. Now, I also want to be very clear that this is specific to what we are looking at in our own institution. I cannot speak for every single medical school.
Sure.
There are probably medical schools out there who have already done a phenomenal job of doing what we call decolonizing their curricula and being very mindful about how they're teaching these different disease processes to students. But there are more of us that have room for growth, mm-hmm. and have room for modification. But back to the conversation that I was having with a student, she was very frustrated about the ways in which some of these disease processes were being presented. And, you know, she was so frustrated, and she felt almost as if the faculty didn't care that they were providing biased information. And what I told her is that it is possible that the faculty does not know that it's biased information, mm-hmm. because that was the way that they were taught. If you were taught something one way for 20 years, mm-hmm. and you have become an expert, why would you begin to think that, oh, well, no, this information that I'm presenting is inaccurate? So, you know, what I told her is, I said, this is a process for us as faculty. We have to go back and look at everything and re-examine everything to figure out where we've gone astray and what we need to do. But that takes time, and it takes faculty development. It takes having experts at your institution who can actually have coherent conversations about this. It takes people at your institution that can facilitate these conversations and manage the emotions which will come up in the conversation about a curricular content being potentially biased. Because again, we go into medical education because we're passionate about helping develop the next, you know, stage of physicians coming into the workforce. We don't go in to create a biased environment. So in a lot of ways, we're doing the best we can with what we have, but we still have room to grow. We
right.
still have room to grow.
Right. Well, the first step in making change is recognizing that there's a problem. Mm-hmm. And maybe problem isn't the best word to use, but recognizing that maybe things should be changed. But it's the recognition that something needs to change. If that doesn't happen, then things won't. So in order for change to occur, you have to recognize that there's something there that necessitates change.
And I kind of wonder, like, as social media and electronics and everything in the digital age increases our ability to communicate with individuals the world over, will that dynamic hopefully help expand people's outlook and possibly, you know, like if you're in communication with physicians from all over the world in different countries, then will that be able to improve, you know, I don't even know where I'm going with this, but more of the, you know, your outlook becomes more global, and you see people mm-hmm. as people and can learn from people around the world, you know, different perspectives and how they see things, and, you know, maybe just make everybody just more aware.
I hope so.
Mm-hmm. So I think access to information, you know, has obviously grown exponentially, and social media can definitely be a tool to disseminate information and to foster sort of international collaboration. The important thing to recognize is that your social media presence may or may not actually be reflective of what you're doing in your own practice. So the real work is inside. The real work is internal. And I think the other thing to be careful about with social media is there are groups of folks who are so emboldened and impassioned about their perspective, and they're sort of locked in. And when other folks try to sort of foster conversations or present a different perspective, I'm sure you guys have seen this on social media. They just block them. They're like, no, I don't want to talk to that person. I'm just going to block them.
And I guess it opens up things for very extreme views.
Right.
Yeah. I think the challenge there is if you are only consuming information from one group or one perspective, you're limiting your ability to understand the whole picture. And while I have my own perspective, I still engage with and I still converse with people who have very, very different approaches and opinions. Because I think that is what is going to enable me to get better at having conversations that are difficult. And it's going to, again, foster a potential collaborative environment. You know, you may never fully change someone's mind, but you may simply plant a seed in which they start thinking. And that's okay.
I 100% agree with you. I mean, we're talking medicine here, but just in general, if you don't openly listen to somebody else for a different perspective, you're never going to grow. And that's really what this is all about. It's growing.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to actively listen and want to learn and understand. And after you have all the information, you still may or may not agree with it, but you've gotten a different perspective. So, you know, I'm in complete agreement with that. On more of a personal note, for you personally, what has been your biggest challenge as a healthcare provider, and what did you learn from it? We hit you with the hard questions here.
That is a hard question. I think I would have to say that right now in this moment, my biggest challenge is self-care. I mean, when you commit your life to taking care of other people, that consumes you in some ways. And when you feel needed, you have this compunction to just continue to press on and press on and press on, even when you're sort of feeling stretched and you're feeling that your bandwidth is limited. You know, you really want to continue to give and give and give. And so finding a way in which to protect my own health and my own wellness with regard to taking care of my son and, you know, I think that's something that I'm still struggling with. And as far as what I'm learning from that experience, ultimately, and I'm much better at dishing out this advice than I am about taking this advice, but if you don't take care of yourself, you will not be able to take care of other people. You will burn out. Your candle will burn bright until it burns out. And so I'm trying to find little ways in which to take care of myself. And, you know, part of it is, you know, going on walks with my son and making sure that when I'm not working clinically or doing my academic stuff, I do protect time to spend with my son. And I try not to do work in that time. But I'm still, you know, after he goes to bed, I'm pulling the computer out and I'm working on curriculum or I'm writing, you know, emails to facilitate some projects that we're working on. And when in fact, I probably should just go to sleep. I think that's one of the biggest challenges that I am still actively experiencing and still learning from. I do want to go back a little bit because what I neglected to talk about in our last question was the impact on medical students and medical students of color in particular coming into to become physicians.
Sure.
And so there are ways in which we are trying to get better at this. but there are also ways in which we are failing to get better at this. And so there's a couple of things with regard to entrance into medical school. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of ways in which medical applications are assessed by admissions committees. And so it's grades, it is extracurricular activities, it is research, and then it's your in-person interview, right? Mm-hmm. So there's also an entrance exam, the MCAT. So if you are a person who gets good grades, but not excellent grades, you're already down a little bit on the sort of the way they categorize students. If your extracurricular activities are limited to your part-time job, which you're doing because you have to support your family, and you're not doing volunteering in the hospital to shadow physicians, and you're not doing bench research, or you're not writing papers because you're responsible for getting your school age siblings to school and taking care of your grandmother who has an illness and also getting to your job so that you can pay for your undergraduate education, mm-hmm. you are objectively lower on the desirable candidate. Because you get certain sort of points, if you will, for each of those categories. And then for the MCAT, so the MCAT is the entrance exam for a medical school. It is expensive. It is difficult. And I did not do well on my first MCAT at all. My second MCAT, I took a prep course, which cost me about $2,000. And I did that while I was working full-time in the ICU every weekend and going to school Monday through Friday. So I had the capacity to take this course because I worked as a nurse and I was making a reasonable salary. But if you are a 20-year-old college kid who is working at, you know, Starbucks or whatever, you know, part-time job to support your family and your education and your tuition, you're not going to have extra money to take that prep course to blow the MCAT out of the water. So now you got four things against you. All right. You also may not have a mentor. You may not have a guide. You may not have anybody who can vouch for you. So when admissions committees look at these applications in front of them, how many of those do you think are in the discard pile that are likely to be Black, Indigenous, or otherwise persons of color? Quite a few of them are.
Yeah, it sounds like privilege. They're judging you on how privileged you are. And that doesn't mean, mm-hmm. you know, because you're privileged doesn't mean that you're going to be a good physician.
Right. Actually, we went out of our way to seek out, and this is how this doctor got started. He was an illegal immigrant from Mexico. He was a farmhand in California, and he saved up enough money to learn English, and now he is a world-renowned neurosurgeon working out of Mayo. This was Dr. Quinones, and he had a terrible start.
Right, but he's an outlier that he was actually able to work through the system.
Right.
But
so how many people, right. I mean, so there's got to be a lot of people of color that have disadvantages, and I don't know how they can possibly
It sounds like the system needs to change.
Yes, to support them.
Yeah. Just I think that there's a couple of things that we can do. So medical schools can examine other ways and other metrics by which to review applications. But the things that we can also do is we can foster and develop and create pipeline programs that allow for mentorship for these students and create scholarship for these students, mm-hmm. you know, so that they can take an MCAT if they need to. The other thing that we haven't even gotten into is how much money it costs to apply for medical school. Mm-hmm. It is on average, if you're applying to 10 medical schools, probably another like $1,500 to $2,000
wow.
to apply. Okay. After you apply, Many schools will send out a secondary application, which requires a secondary fee.
Wow.
What are these schools doing with these fees?
And then you said that you also have to do an interview as part of the process.
Yep.
So I'm assuming that you have to
travel.
Right.
You have to pay for lodging.
Right.
You have to make sure you look nice.
Right.
And, you know, so that kind of can lead into the challenges of medical students of color once they get into medical school. So I'm sure you guys have heard of the term microaggressions.
Yes.
So microaggressions, and I am 100% guilty of being a deliverer of microaggressions because I didn't know any better. Now I'm much more mindful of it. But telling a person of color, oh, you're so articulate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like, would you say that to your white colleague?
Wow.
Like, I cannot remember the last time I've said that to any of my white colleagues. You know, and again, this is part of the reflection, kind of going back and trying to think about the things that I've done,
mm-hmm.
which were
right.
potentially harmful. They were harmful to my relationship with my students because it probably, number one, it made them feel uncomfortable. It probably degraded the trust that they had in me as their provider. Comments about hair. Oh, your hair, can I touch it? Would you do that to a person on the street?
I don't even understand when you would do that.
That happens a lot, like when women are pregnant and people come up and they'll just touch their belly
without asking. Yes.
Yeah,
just reach in and grab a handful.
100%.
Yep. Yeah.
I cannot tell you how many times patients in the emergency department touched my belly before I even introduced myself as their physician.
Oh, my
gosh. I started standing at the foot of the bed because it made me so uncomfortable.
Oh, mm-hmm. I'm so sorry.
But I mean, that's another example of ways in which, you know, people cross boundaries and make people uncomfortable without even realizing it.
And hopefully,
If the listeners are curious about microaggressions, there's a great YouTube video. It's about 2 minutes long that really kind of talks about the long-term impact of microaggressions, because these are very small statements or actions, and they seem to be minimal in their impact. But the thing is it's like a paper cut.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep doing it over and over and over again, it degrades the other person's confidence. It degrades their ability to sort of engage in a way where they feel respected and acknowledged. The other thing is there's something called code switching, in which persons of color will come into an academic setting and feel like they have to dress differently, talk differently. They have to moderate their personality. They have to moderate their whole personhood to assimilate into expected behavior. And that's exhausting. You know, you shouldn't have to do that. But because if they don't do it, then they are discriminated against in some way with, it may just be a side eye,
mm-hmm.
or it may be a comment about something on their evaluation, that this student was very loud and obnoxious. You know, the ways in which this impacts, and this is, it's not just in medicine. I mean, I think this is in the entire academic industry. And it's interesting. There's a tweet trend, a hashtag that has been going around on Twitter, and it's called hashtag Black in the Ivory. And it is a bunch of folks in academic institutions describing their experiences. It's very interesting and very informative for you to sort of take a look at. So
yes,
if you guys are interested,
we will. Yes.
Just take a look at that.
Amazing.
Well, and I think just as far as, you know, like as far as worldview, even television shows can help people be more aware of situations and language usage and word usage and how it can affect
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
And but again, hopefully as we open up more globally, you know, that'll improve.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Well, can I ask you, like, how have your friends and family, you said you came from a blue collar family, how has your family supported you, and how have your friends supported you throughout your career?
Mm-hmm. So my family, you know, all the members of my family have always been my biggest cheerleaders. They're very supportive emotionally at each step of the path for me. And so they're, you know, they're there, they're bragging about me. Oh, you know, Kathleen's a doctor in Washington, D.C. So my friends and family have always been incredibly supportive of my path. And, you know, to my friends in Las Vegas, who I worked with in the hospital, and, you know, even my friends outside the hospital there, when I went away for medical school, they put together this grand party, and they had all collected money to help me with my books.
Wow.
For medical school.
That's fantastic.
And they gave me $3,000 in cash.
Wow.
Nice.
To help me with my medical school books, because medical school books are expensive.
Mm-hmm. I bet.
So
I guess that goes to that kind of goes to show that going from making that transition from nursing to being a doctor was accepted by your colleagues. The your fellow nurses, they accepted your choice to change careers, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean they knew from early on that that was my plan. I mean, I was in the ICU for probably about 6 months when I made the decision to go back to school and get my bachelor's and apply to medical school. So they were with me during the entire transition.
Okay.
So, you know, my friends in nursing were 100% supportive. The physicians, there was only one physician actually at my hospital who was supportive, and she was actually a woman of color and an anesthesiologist, and she was remarkable. But the other ones were like, they're not going to want a nurse.
Wow.
They're going to think that you're stuck in your ways. You're just a nurse. You don't belong in medicine.
Wow.
That's so disturbing.
Old boys club.
Well, not old.
It was.
Yeah. That's very sad. Sorry.
I'm the
to
only
hear
boy
you.
In the room here. Thank you.
But you're not an old boy.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously didn't stop me. Mm-hmm. It sort of emboldened me and empowered me more. So.
You know, that's great. Sometimes you take people saying no, 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 and you just are determined enough to say, watch me.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, what's the best advice you've ever received? And what kind of advice do you have for new physicians coming up?
I think the best advice that I have received really, again, goes back to what Dean Haywood told me about don't get furious, get curious.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because being angry or being frustrated takes up a lot of energy, and being curious in some ways is actually restorative, because you're really kind of filling your cup with more information. And I think that has been really remarkable for me in the way I approach challenges currently. As far as what I would say to new physicians, I would say, again, and it goes back to self-care and me dishing out the things that, you know, I'm not great at applying to my own life. Make sure that you are carving out time and protecting time for yourself to find a restorative activity. You know, even if it's just, you know, 5 minutes a day or one day a week where you say, no, this is my day where I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to answer emails. I'm not going to, you know, do anything medical. I'm going to just, you know, focus on me. And I think the thing is as new physicians, making that a habit early on is essential. And this really sort of comes on the back end of recognizing the mental health impacts on physicians of overworking and of sort of taking on too many responsibilities. Because again, we are humans, and we are susceptible to all medical illnesses, you know, mental health illnesses, And we need to be able to advocate for ourselves so that we continue to be able to give back to our patients.
Yeah, that's great advice. You're actually preaching to the choir because, like Lita mentioned earlier, she and I are both recreation therapists, so we understand the value of you can't help others if you're not helping yourself. So that's fantastic advice. We also saw that you are an author. We talked about that briefly earlier. So could you talk a little bit about the Chronicles of Women in White Coats, the book series, and also Mothers in Medicine?
Absolutely. So the Chronicles of Women in White Coats book series was put together by a colleague of mine who is a family medicine doctor here in Washington, D.C. And the first book they put out, I think it was about 2 years ago, and it was a collection of personal stories of women physicians. And, you know, some of them are directly related to our roles as doctors. Some of them are not at all related to being a doctor, but is in fact the intersection between having a life as a physician and how that interplays with your role as a physician. And so one of my colleagues who graduated from my emergency medicine program was an author in the first book. And she reached out to me to ask if I would be interested in contributing to this book. And I thought, well, that sounds like a really interesting opportunity. And so I started thinking about what I would write about, and in sort of the same time frame, I also had an opportunity to speak at a conference called FIX19. It's put together by this organization called FEMIN-EM. It's Females Working in Emergency Medicine, and they did sort of a TED Talk-like presentations for folks, and you had to apply. And, you know, I was one of the speakers, and I had a coach, and Diane Birnbaumer is a phenomenal force of nature in the emergency medicine education community, and she was my coach. And we worked through my presentation, which was a very personal story about my life experiences. And part of my journey in writing for this book and also preparing for that talk at FIX was recognizing that, you know, when you think about discrimination and you think about what people's assumptions are about you, for me, again, being someone who grew up in an alcoholic home with, you know, domestic violence and child abuse, I had been ashamed of those things, and I had tried to hide those things for most of my adult life because I was worried about how people would perceive me. I was worried people would feel sorry for me, or they would think somehow that I was less than because of these experiences. And I, as an academician, I regularly counsel medical students and residents. And I found in my meetings with students who were having troubles and who were having struggles, they kind of put me up on this pedestal of like, oh, she's so great, and everything's so easy for her, and she just does everything awesome. And I just felt like their perception of me, it was manufactured by what they were seeing, right? And so I was putting forth this energy like, oh, it's just easy to be me, and it's easy to do all these things. And I felt that that was disingenuous, and I felt like it was important for me to acknowledge and share a piece of my story and my struggles and the challenges that I have met along the way, because those have informed who I am as a physician. Those have informed how I interact with my patients. And I also wanted people to be very clear that you can go through these experiences and come out stronger on the other side and still find success and happiness and wellness. And so that's really sort of what inspired me to get involved with the Chronicles of Women in White Coats. As far as Mothers in Medicine is concerned, one of our deans of student affairs, Dean Kathy Christian here at GW, invited me to contribute to the blog Mothers in Medicine some time ago. And it was shortly after my divorce, And I'll tell you that my ex-husband and I have a phenomenal co-parenting relationship now. We have locked in how to take care of our son together, and that's really been our priority. There were some challenges along the way, and, you know, being a new attending physician, going through a divorce, managing a toddler and the childcare challenges that are associated with that. And, you know, the Mothers in Medicine blog really talks a lot about being the challenges of being a mother in medicine. And so I shared some of my experiences on the blog as well.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And I think hearing from someone who's been there and has gotten through that, and not only gotten through it, but really excelled, is a great inspiration for others who may be in a similar situation. So that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing your stories with everyone and inspiring everyone. I'd like to know, how can we learn more about you? How can we buy the book? And what do you have planned for the future? Because you sound like a very, very, very busy person. And how do you find the time?
Yeah. Oh, goodness. So people can get a hold of me, or they can follow me on social media. My most of my social media activity is on Twitter, from a medicine standpoint. And so you can find me at Dr. Kitty Cat.
Oh.
So it's DrKittyKat. And so that is the platform on which I share a lot of the information that I do with regard to ultrasound, women in leadership, gender bias, racial bias, and sort of my anti-racist journey. And folks can also find my professional information on the GW School of Medicine and Health Sciences faculty directory. And as far as what's next, I would love to find myself on the speaker circuit. My experience with FIX-19 was transformative. The energy that I gave to that experience, and also what I garnered and what I gleaned from the audience when they came up to me after the talk and shared its impact on them, was really, really incredible. And I enjoy speaking, and I enjoy telling my story. So I think that would be something that I would love to do. As far as how I make time for everything, it's interesting. As an emergency physician, and not everybody has the constitution to be able to manage the multiple different shifts a week, but in some ways, the fact that my clinical schedule is days, nights, evenings, weekends, I have random pockets of time during the middle of the week that are open, in which I can fulfill my academic obligations with teaching my students and engaging with my residents. And then, you know, the evenings, if I'm not in the ER, those are reserved for my son. And, you know, we go on trips. He's my little travel buddy. So hopefully we can get through this pandemic so he and I can start traveling again, because he would love to travel internationally, which we've not done yet. So I think that those things are on the horizon. I think ultimately I probably will end up writing my own book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that my work with Mothers in Medicine and the Chronicles of Women in White Coats book series has inspired me to do more writing. And as far as where you guys can get the book, you can go to the Chronicles of Women in White Coats. Let me just make sure that I'm getting that correct. It is available on Amazon, but I will also tell you that because we are self-published, you can actually support individual authors by going directly to our website. So it is the Chronicles of Women in White Coats .com. And I would love to have folks get the book. You will be blown away by the stories that you read. It is 9 women of color. It is 4 or 5 emergency physicians. There are 2 family medicine physicians. There's a pediatrician. There's an adolescent and child medicine specialist. There is an internal medicine doctor who is a nephrologist. And there are stories about being an immigrant to this country and sort of the challenges of being in medicine from that perspective. There are stories of challenges of being a patient as a physician, you know, having a medical illness and having to be on the patient side of it and what that was like. There's some discussion of racial bias and gender bias. And I think it's a book really for anyone who's interested in the life of women in medicine. I think it would be an excellent read for you.
Great. Yeah.
We'll definitely get a copy.
Yes. Yes. We're looking forward to buying our copy.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Urgel, thank you so much for taking the time out to come on our show and talk with us today. And yeah, we look forward to seeing greater quality in healthcare and also reading the book you just talked about, The Chronicles of Women in White Coats, the book series. Again, we appreciate you coming on, a plethora of information, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It was great.
And on a totally, on a side note, if you ever do get the chance and everything, you know, picks back up in the world, the TED Talk conferences are supposed to have the best curated snacks in the world. They have an entire team that works on their snack procurement, and they spend over a year conceiving, you know, like to make sure that all different interests are covered, all different food allergies, all, you know, so it's supposed to be an amazing spread.
Come for the stay for the food.
Stay right, for the food, right. And then make sure you let us know how it goes afterwards, because we want to know, hear all about
gosh.
It.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, you guys.
You're
have a
welcome.
Wonderful day.
You
thanks,
too, Doctor.
You too.
If our listeners have any questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, through our website, podcastdx.com, on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, or Instagram.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast. As always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment, and before undertaking a new healthcare regime, and never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking because of something you've heard in this podcast.
Till next week.